Welcome to Foundation and Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Foundation on Apple TV+. This is the feedback episode for Season 1, Episode 5, Upon Awakening. Respect and enjoy the podcast.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the first of our feedback-only issues of the podcast, talking about Foundation. If you're hearing this and it's not Friday, the 21st, the 22nd? It's not Friday the 22nd. You still may have time to get in some email, get a question to be considered for our interview with David Goyer, the showrunner of Foundation. Send your feedback in to foundation@baldmove.com and make sure you put Goyer, G-O-Y-E-R, in the subject line so I can harvest that in time for the discussion, because that should probably be released next week as a special edition podcast. But yeah, we got our immediate pressing business is to see what people think about episode 5 and all the season so far at the halfway point. Foundation@baldmove.com is where you send that feedback in, and let's just go right to it. Rick K is up first, says, I love the show and the depth you go into. Well, thanks, Rick. Is Cleon the First still alive, or was he frozen somehow? Why is he in that contraption? I feel like the look on his face seems like he's very surprised. He also doesn't look to be in bad health or otherwise near death. I wonder if Demerzel surprised him and he's pulling the strings of these puppets. What do you think of that?
I hadn't considered that. I thought he was frozen in carbonite implies that he's alive. I thought he was dead, but preserved in a cocoon of essentially resin. I don't know. Whatever that stuff is.
Yeah, I don't, because Demerzel said it was harder for the First because he had to go through this knowing there was only a baby with his eyes. And this implies the disintegration chamber, but we know he wasn't disintegrated, or at least
no.
I feel like that body is his real body.
Yeah.
So maybe the First one, they did like flash freeze him. Maybe there is a potential to like thaw him out and get the pure.
Is that where they're getting the clone DNA from? Do they have like a little hole in there? Do they stick a big needle in and pull out a few stem
like
cells?
Jurassic Park, yeah. Like he's Jurassic Park.
This is
mosquito.
The Amber.
And yeah, I don't know. I don't know how they do the process. Since he is unique and singular in the fact that his body is preserved, because until the disintegration chamber happened, like we talked about, I fully expected when he stepped into that flickering machine that he was going to be, like you said, frozen in carbonite or whatever the hell this is. Mm-hmm. I was shocked when they got disintegrated. So this is a singular thing as far as we know. Them keeping the Cleon Prime's body in some kind of corporal state. So whether that's significant or not, again, cannot stress this enough, the books do not touch on any of this stuff. No, no. So, you know, who knows? It does seem like they are going to certainly be more personal and hands-on with the destruction of the Empire, or the disillusion, or the floundering of the Empire. Like, we're going to go really see degeneration of the Galactic Empire. Mm-hmm. Rick also says, regarding Harry, watching a scene where he was killed, they showed Raish remove something from behind his ear. That's some sort of monitoring device. Was removal of that device what caused the ship to say he was dead? We noticed that in episode 2, and I kept on waiting for it to be relevant, but you're right. He does have something behind his ear that was removed, and I'm not sure the show has given any more hints about what that is.
No, honestly, I didn't even remember it from three episodes ago. So
those are definitely things to keep our eye on for unanswered questions going forward. But yeah, you hit on some mysteries here, Rick. Mm-hmm. We'll have to see what the show says about them together. Next up, Dom. I don't know that Salvor has a power per se. I took her predictive abilities more like a very intense burst of deductive reasoning, kind of like Sherlock on the show Sherlock. It felt to me like she was hyper-focusing on behavior and facts to produce her deductions on the Grand Huntress. I can't explain her ability to walk through the null field, but I will try. Let's pause here. I thought the whole point of the coin trick was to point out that this is not something that could happen naturally, or at least it's exceedingly unlikely.
Yeah, there's no body language to read from a coin, right? There's no tells that a coin would have when you flip it. Yeah. Unless she's just very attuned to her own physical motor processes, and when she flips a coin, she can intuitively tell how hard she flipped it and, you know, therefore which side it's going to land on. You have to do a lot of like stretching to say that this is somehow not a like power she has, but I don't know, I'd label that a power.
Yeah, she'd have to have some kind of superhuman control over her body and like super fat, like, you know, can detect, can actually see the coin flipping in real time and can snatch it. And the other thing is, or if it's a trick coin, I feel like the episode needed to tell us that episode. Like, Hugo's like, how did you do that? And she's like, trick coin. And she shows something and it just like morphs back and forth or something. So like, if we find out three episodes that this was some kind of trick, because if it's just her, you know, cold reading Farrah, because you could say that this is like, you know, a psychic doing a cold read. Like, hey, is there anyone in the room who has family that was destroyed by Trantor? Is you. Oh, okay. And you must have had a brother. No, a sister. Like, that's one thing, but the coin flipping, I think, is there to specifically say this is something supernatural. But we'll see. Dom wants to explain how she can walk through the null field without special powers. Let's see if he does it. If we know that there's a preventive field that surrounds the Empire to protect him, and it's a DNA-based thing, perhaps the null field is set up by Seldon using the same technology to account in a way for the eventual outlier in Salver Hardin. Maybe she has some permission based in her DNA, which would point to her being Gale and Raish's kid, which would really pay off on the idea that Seldon may be orchestrating more than we thought here. Could be crazy. I don't know. I find it hard to believe these things aren't connected. I feel like the show is telling us without holding our hands.
There, I agree with you. I think there is a connection between all these things. We just don't have enough information yet to know what it is.
Yeah, the DNA thing seems strong because I guess I was leaning more towards, well, it's just she has some kind of special power. But you're right. All the fields that they've talked about so far have all been coded based on DNA. The thing that protects the settlement, the thing that protects Empire. It might not be like her whatever precog abilities unlock. It's probably just genetic. And I at this point, like, I know I've been kind of pussyfooting around it, but like, I feel like the show is just unambiguously pointing us down to the Salver is that I guess the embryo that was removed from Gale in episode two
could certainly be. And I think, the more information we get, the more likely that seems. The other thing I wanted to talk briefly about that kind of relates to all this is I don't think Harry Seldon and the Foundation or Terminus or whatever have any like it's super advanced technology, right? Beyond what the Empire has. So when hasn't told us that if it were to be true. So any of the technology we've seen needs to be sort of constrained by what we know of the Empire's technology.
Right,
and so that genetic stuff, that makes a lot of sense. If Harry Seldon, I mean, he would, at the point that they've got like the embryos, he would have genetic material, right, that he could code from. That is totally possible.
Let's move on to JP telling us a tale of woe and tragedy that was happily averted. Says, I wanted to say a quick thanks for saving Foundation for me. I saved up Foundation for watching during a work trip and watched the first three episodes. I thought it was compelling, but I thought it's way too clever for its own good with all the time jumps and the non-linear storytelling. Found the clone succession fascinating. Jared Harris dying in episode one totally blew me away. Then these random characters battling space archers on Terminus was cool, but hard to follow, especially when episode three showed their arrival and the actual fighting had taken place in episode two. Way too timey-wimey, so I gave it up. I thought I'd listen to your views on the long drive home, and that's when I realized I'd mixed up the episode order and accidentally watched episodes 2, 4, and 3 in that order.
Oh, God.
Complex storytelling, to say the least.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks for helping me realize the cock up, and I'll go back and watch episode one and see if things are a bit clearer. I imagine they will be. You know what? I got screwed up on an Apple TV program too. Somehow I watched an episode of this season's Ted Lasso. There's a character that was like kind of a big deal for him to come back to the team and to the show. And I'm like, oh boy, the next episode, I can't wait to see how they deal with that. And the next episode, it's like fully integrated, no bubbles, no troubles, no commentary. And I'm like, geez, that was kind of a big nothing burger. And I found out that I'd flipped the episodes around too. This has nothing to do with the quality of the foundation. Apple TV's interface, at least on my TV, is kind of quirky.
Quirky, in the same way,
I don't know, man. Like, I feel like all of these things have slightly different flaws. Like, for example, the flaw of HBO Max is you can continue watching something, but if you want to go to like the next episode or explore the seasons or stuff, you really got to go around Robin Hood's barn to get to where you want to go. It's like four or five clicks and you're forced to play something before you can abandon it and go to more. I feel like there's a little bit of that with the Apple TV stuff. For example, if I want to watch Foundation, I almost can never get to it from the main screen. I have to like go and scroll through the TV series and get to that way, or hope it's on the top banner, or I don't know. And I feel like that was part of the problem with the Ted Lasso is that you were watching episodes too. So I assumed it was where I left off. It was where, cause it doesn't support user profiles. So,
right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a real nightmare. I found that like a lot of these services, when you watch the last episode in a series, will just kind of remove it from your view until there's a new episode. But if you want to go back and watch an episode again, which I frequently watch these episodes twice, then you have to go digging. You have to go to the archives.
And
it's like, you know, an infinite number of hexagonal rooms with an infinite number of 410 page texts.
Right. I feel like that a lot of this stuff, I feel like IT patents must be the blame, because there's like got to be a ideal way to present media to people. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, serialized media collected into episodes and seasons, and like they all do it different because they probably all have exclusive patents on the one click to watch it probably. Or whatever. Like, you know, Amazon had the buy, you know, they had a patent for click one buying things at one point. It's a mess. We need another 10 years to sort all this stuff out. Let's move on to Josh. So, hey guys, just got done listening to the latest episode where Jim, I think, proposed that maybe Azura was a plant, no pun intended, knowing that Brother Dawn would throw himself out the window. Azura, I think, is the gardener.
Yeah, the attendant.
Aaron pointed out that they couldn't know that because you can't predict an individual's actions, only the whole of society. Ah, but the Empire is not an individual. It's a single person that lives over and over and over again for 400 years. So this could actually make Empire's actions equally quite predictable. I find him always asking this question. Is this the first time that a brother has done this, or does this happen every time? I feel like it's definitely the latter. I feel like Demerzel's role is to make sure that every new brother stays on track. It's important that the person closest to the Empire is one who never changes and who knows every one of his or their predictions, or predilections, rather. She's seen it all and can anticipate and most likely guide them to a predetermined outcome. I guess my point is, I like the idea of Azura as part of a family that has placed themselves in a position to be able to have some influence over a Dawn when he eventually stumbles or questions the way things are the way they are. Who knows? Maybe they've even tried this before. This is a good question. What do you make about psychohistory working on the individual of Cleon because he's not an individual?
Well, that's not how I understand psychohistory. It's more prediction of the masses, not prediction of a single being. And I don't want to say like one person, because yes, you could say that Cleon is many people. I don't know. But he's certainly not the masses, right?
So like, it's an open question of whether psychohistory would work on Earth. Like, if we were to discover it, psychohistory, would psychohistory work with a roughly 8 billion people and, I don't know, 8,000 years of recorded history partially to work with? I don't know that it would. Like, I think my understanding of psychohistory is it literally takes trillions of people over millennia to get the model to where you can then make predictions based on like the masses of people. Mm. Like it's like big, you know, we even talked about like is Terminus too small of a collection of individuals to properly simulate and the psychohistory or analyze. I don't know. And I don't know what the, cause the show might have a different opinion of that than my opinion and the book's opinion. So, but yeah, I think 14 people is with 400 years is by any definition too small a sample.
Yeah, and I think the show has already told us in the first episode that he can't predict the Empire's movements, right? Because he thought he was going to be killed at the trial.
Right.
And that didn't happen. So, yeah, that was all within the purview of Empire. So, probably not.
If I'm a show watcher, I think the idea that Harry Seldon might be full of shit is mm-hmm. definitely in the mind, because like not only can he not make individual predictions, but like, you know, how the Empire would react. But I guess that's where it starts breaking down, because he's trying to guess what an individual the Empire would do to him, an individual, and he was obviously off. But even if if he's off on that, then how does that affect his calculations? I mean, that's clearly what they're playing with you know, this escape pod backup plan that may or may not have been intended for Raish at this point. Like it's mm-hmm. it's hard to tell. It's hard to tell. As far as the idea of Azura is like some kind of outside person trying to gain influence over Dawn, that's a brilliant idea. I hadn't considered it. I thought that she's just kind of being sucked into this thing because she just happened. Because that's the thing. Okay, like, how didn't we even say that in episode 4? Like, if this is an outside agent, how the hell would you know that this guy's going to jump out the window and have this meet cute at the scene of the suicide? Like, wow. Do you just like, you know, try like, are 95% of the palace gardeners plants from different outside agencies or whatnot? Like, I don't know. So that's the hurdle I have to buy on that theory. But it'd be a great theory. Yeah, if you can buy off the Empire's babysitter, mm-hmm. His wet nurse, you've got a huge influence over them. So we'll see if that's where they're going with the story. Marcus says, regarding the odd behavior of Brother Dawn from episode 4, could this be signs the clones are degrading? Maybe a descent into Mad Emperor territory with each subsequent generation? When Brother Dusk is about to die in the previous episode and saw the new Brother Dawn being born, didn't he say something like something's wrong here before being hurried along by Demerzel to be disintegrated? You are correct. He did say something's wrong at the time. I mean, at the time we both interpreted that as just him getting cold feet. Mm-hmm. And like, this is something that like maybe, you know, every emperor, when it's time for him to shuffle off, it's like, whoa, there must be something wrong with the plan. It can't be time for me to die. I still have more to say and still more to do. Yeah. Like, and that still could be the case, but it does seem like, I don't know. I feel like the new Emperor Dawn was half baked. He's either openly rebelling against the way and kind of like shuffling his feet and slouching and not sitting up straight the way like a rebellious teen does, or he's just not as studious as we've seen other emperors be, the one other emperor we've seen as a child, you know?
Yeah, no, you're right. There's something wrong here with Dawn. I guess we'll just see how it plays out.
RJ, in your discussion of the third episode, you talked about Seldon's people who are setting up the foundation, and it dawned on me that while these people were following Harry and quite intelligent, they're also children of the Empire, people who are afraid to take missteps. They're literally sheep. I think they didn't they say that the vast majority of these people even came from Trantor?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So he continues, Harry Seldon knew this and also recognized that his living with his followers would mean that he would become just a man. This is highlighted when a person working in the botanical gardens called him Harry. Seldon understood that for the foundation to succeed, belief in it had to be stronger than one man could sustain, but a martyr is much more powerful. The power of a martyr is mentioned a couple of times. Just a few thoughts. I don't know. Do you think this is a problem that, you know, the show has told us the people who are afraid to make, you know, to are too afraid about some kind of grand plan or design or job can make mistakes. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's a fair characterization of the people from Terminus?
It could be, but I think, like, importantly, this is the kind of thing that psychohistory is designed to actually predict, right? Is how people of a culture, when faced with different things, different stimulus, are going to react and interact with each other. So I think if Harry, everything Harry was doing was done for a reason. And I think he correctly surmises that, yes, a martyr is going to be more powerful than one man because it creates a movement. It creates, you know, something larger than himself. And that's kind of what we're seeing play out. And I think you're always going to have people sort of drifting in and out of that, right? Whether they're from Tranto or not, you're going to have people who are like, well, you know, I'm not really on board with the Harry Selden guy anymore. You know, I'm just here living my life now, and I happen to be on Terminus or whatever. But you're also going to have the movement that hopefully can withstand some people breaking off from it, and maintain this strong core over time.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
This Tuesday, we're back off the clock with a new premium podcast covering our experiences with the new Amazon series Fallout, Alex Garland's Civil War, as well as some thoughts on X-Men 97.
Then on Friday, The Old Reliable, Lunch with Jim and Aaron. Join us in the Munch Crowd to watch us record live at 1 p.m. Eastern, or check out the podcast later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Let's move on to JJ Johnson, who says, I think you're missing a fundamental piece of psychohistory. Not only does it take a very large group of people to make predictions, it also takes a very long range of time. It's easy to forget how long 500 years or 1,000 years actually are. These long intervals, one person might change what happens for a generation or even several generations, but 500 years, in a 500-year span, there's about 20 generations. So if some of the model predicts an event will happen, but it doesn't because one person prevented it, there's still many more opportunities for that event to happen. Yeah, no, so like, I don't know, maybe we did a bad job explaining it. I think I understood both of those things, but this fine point at the end of like if the emperor... There's a prediction that some rebellion would happen and the empire would successfully quash that rebellion. I imagine in psychohistory that would just ratchet up the pressure on that particular thing, and that pressure would then go to some other outlet to be relieved. Mm-hmm. So, and even Harry'd say, it's like, I don't know if this is going to happen. Like, you could probably lengthen your demise. You could probably hasten your demise, but you can't escape it. Like, it's kind of like Thanos.
Well, you know,
there's a certain inevitability over the course of time once these conditions have been met.
It's like a nuclear reactor that's going critical, right? And there's no way to put the genie back in the bottle here. Yeah, you could release some of the pressure, maybe cool it temporarily, but eventually that thing is going to boil over and cause problems. So.
And there's an open question of, like, if Harry were born 2,000 years ago and they invented psychohistory then, would there still be enough time to, like, right the ship and get it to steer straight down the track? Or would this fall still already, like, when was the fall inevitable? Once you get, and then that's the thing, is like, once you get the galaxy on even keel, would psychohistory mean that you could eternally keep it there? And what does that even mean?
Maybe.
Yeah, we'll have to see. We'll have to see where this show goes with this these questions. Ryan's up next. Says, during your discussion of the new day Cleon berating his statisticians, You mentioned the similarity of someone using the voice for power and control vis-a-vis Dune. I giggled when you made the Dune connection, but not the obvious one. The statistician who collapsed dead is none other than Ian McNeice, who played the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen in sci-fi's 2000 Dune remake miniseries.
Wow.
I did not realize that, because I only saw the Dune sci-fi series once, and it was like when it first came out, and I didn't think a lot of it. But now that you mention it, this guy, if I take 20 years, and I think he's about as heavy, because the Baron's always portrayed as fat.
Mm-hmm.
I think, yeah, I can squint and see. That's pretty funny, though. But it was such a Viggo Mortensen broke his toe in the scene moment for me at the podcast, and I'm such a huge fan, I instantly had to let everyone around me know. Well, I'm glad I gave you that moment's pleasure. It's unintentional. I was compelled to do it because, you know, that was my part to play in the Psycho podcast. I have some other rambling thoughts about the show as well. I think the idea of a genetic dynasty for the TV adaptation of Foundation is a masterstroke by David S. Goyer and the rest of the creative team. Makes one half of the storytelling that much easier with the time jumping, as the Emperor does not need to be recast. When you land on talent with such ranges as Lee Pace and Terrence Mann, the Empire storyline becomes much more interesting and impactful to the viewer. Cleon is also an anagram of clone. A fun little call out.
Yeah, Jesus, why didn't I pick up on that? Yep.
Well, the thing is Cleon the First is in the book, right? It's an actual Asmovian character, but there's no cloning in the books. So it's kind of like this, like, backronym, anagram. But it is funny. I wonder if that's something that they were playing with in the writer's room and how they kind of like came up with, because I agree. I think this is the single best insight into the story.
Yes.
So, like, you know, how can you give the other side a drama? Because the books feels very much like the protagonists are just doing things and buffaloing people and coming up with this genetic dynasty. So you can see the, you know, this consistent set of antagonists that are all so different, but you also feel familiar with them, and they're a character unto themselves collectively. I think that's such a cool idea. And it's clearly the thing that's captured your and I's imagination.
Yeah, for sure.
But good catch on the Cleon stuff, Ryan.
Speaking of clones, hold on, I got something to interject here. All right, so this episode we saw Harry Seldon's coffin, right? His specially handcrafted, personally designed coffin,
hand carved.
Is there any chance that we see Harry Seldon in the in the fullness of time here, come back to be a clone dynasty of his own? Can he send his genetic material off to his homeworld or something, where they can clone the man and he can, you know, start up the Dawn, Day, Dusk stuff for himself and become Psycho History, become the Foundation?
Does that mean that we get 8 seasons of Jared Harris?
I just want him back, man. I just want him back.
Yeah, that's exactly what we should do. We should do. You got brother Price, who's the earliest version. That's the Mad Men version of him. You've got brother Croesus. Brother Crozier from The Terror, and then you got brother Seldon when he's and they always bring a clone of Ra's to stab him in the stomach. That's his disintegration chamber. If it means we get 8 more seasons of Jared Harris, then I will accept anything. DLH from Washington, D.C. says, when Empire and the Empire's Advocate questions Harry Seldon about his feel of Psycho History, Harry says that it's a predictive model designed to forecast behavior of very large populations. While he says he's unable to use psychotherapy to predict the actions of individuals or small-scale events, there are multiple examples where both Harry and Gale claim to do exactly that, predict specific events or the consequences of specific actions. So let's look at all these 4 exceptions, and then we'll take them one by one. The first one, Gale claims the Empire will be dead within a year if it executes Harry and his followers. She also claims that if it kills Harry, it will only accelerate the Empire's fall. So that's the first claim. 2, Harry asks for how long when the Empire's Advocate says that Trantor has an Imperial library and tells Gale that stealing a manuscript would be a mercy because the library would soon burn. 3, Harry states the fate of one individual will always remain a mystery, yet he appears to believe that his death is necessary for the Foundation to succeed. And 4, Harry predicted that the Foundation would survive its first crisis. Are there non-psychohistory explanations for each of these instances, or are there some holes in psychotherapy?
Let's go back and look at this. You've said that twice now.
Oh, that's because that's because they consistently spelled it that way. Oh, usually it's just me being a fuckface, but the ALH was the fuckface in this instance. Psychohistory. So edit all the psychohistory.
Yeah, I can explain at least two of these. The first one is a lie. Is an intentional lie.
Gale claims the Empire will be dead within a year if it executes Harry and his followers. I concur. You want to walk us through that reasoning?
I think she says later on that she lied about that. Like, I don't think it's a plain reading. Yeah.
Yeah. Harry asked her, like, oh, so you've seen my calculus? She's like, I've seen most of them. I didn't understand it all, but enough to know that I should kind of back your play. So right. I think she. And maybe that's the thing that Harry didn't account for, that she would lie. And then he would be spared, that's just her making shit up. Like that, she did not see that in the psychohistory equations.
Yeah, probably because he couldn't.
Two, when Harry asked for how long about the Empire's being existing and the library not stealing a manuscript from the library is going to be mercy because the library would be soon burned. What do you think about that one?
We're talking about a man who sees 13,000 years into the future through his psychohistory. Right. His definition of soon is probably not breakfast tomorrow, right? It's probably within the 500 years that it'll take for the Empire to fall. So just grab whatever you can. Let's smash and grab and get out of here.
Yeah, he's trying to avert a 30,000 year dark ages. So even if this happens within 500 or 1,000 years, 5,000 years, that's relatively soon in the context of what we're talking about. So three, Harry states that the fate of one individual will always remain a mystery, yet he appears to believe that his death is necessary for the foundation to succeed. What do you think about that one? Because I've got a pretty good read on it, I think.
I mean, this is the martyr stuff, right? He just understands the power of a martyr.
Because he's not predicting. I mean, he can predict what he can do because he has full agency. He can always kill himself or have one of his acolytes kill him. And he knows, so he is no longer an individual being modeled. What's being modeled is the galaxy at large's reaction to Harry Seldon being murdered by one of his acolytes. He can put that into his equation, just like he can model. He doesn't know what he doesn't know if the Empire would blow up a planet. But if the Empire says, I'm going to blow up this planet, Harry could put that stimulus into the equations and it would then tell him what would happen. So like, it's not modeling an individual behavior. It's he's just a stimulus. He's a cause. And then the effect happens. And then four, Harry predicted the foundation would survive its first crisis. Here's where are we talking about? Is the foundation a stimulus? So like the foundation being created stimulates something in the galaxy that responds to it, or is the foundation a large enough collection of people that he has simulated, you know, as running simulations for 34 years to feed back into the equations? Like, I don't know the answer to that, but probably it's one of those two.
Yeah. The more we talk about this, the more I'm thinking there needs to be some element that constantly readjusts psychohistory. And Harry hasn't really set it up that way. Harry set up a single point in time from which, you know, the foundation will be born, but the people don't know the plan. He knew the plan because he could interpret psychohistory, right? Whereas, I don't see anybody at the foundation who can do that currently. So how do you readjust? Right. Because eventually you're going to get drift, right? From the plan. It's just inevitable. It's entropy.
You have to put more, and you have to have somebody, you know, at the chalkboard looking at the equations that then puts another stimulus, another suicide, another.
And I guess the only person we know who can do that is Gale, right? And Gale is still alive. Gale's headed toward his home planet. I'm wondering if Gale isn't going to be that force going forward.
Right.
Because you almost have to have it to keep any kind of plan on the rails.
Yeah, I know. How is she connected somehow to the vault? Because I will say that, like, you know, there are no spoilers, but this is part of the thing that the books deal with. Like, how do you Harry's plan, once he's dead, is very rigid and brittle. Yeah. And, you know, like, you're dealing in probabilities, like pretty large numbers and pretty large certainties of probabilities. But still, things could go wrong, and over drift of thousands of years, you could get, you know, a suboptimal outcome. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you get it to like the just a thousand years of dark ages? That's what we're aiming for. And the book deals with that. The show has not yet. So, but there's still five episodes. So, let's move on to Ben. Says, I really liked this episode. I thought it had a really good development for the character of Dale. For everyone here who thought that Harry's death was designed for Harry, this was the episode that confirms, or designed by Harry rather. This is the episode that confirmed the theory. When you listen to how Raish speaks when he's looking into the camera about sticking to the plan and how Gale is on a ship that has been arranged by Raish, I think it all sums up as the plan. Firstly, I'm going to start with saying that I've never read the book, nor do I like to browse the internet for any kind of spoilers. However, I came away from this episode with some new ideas about where the show is going and wonder what you both make of it. One, Gale is worried about going to Harry's homeworld because she's been accused of Harry's death. Now, I came away thinking that this part is this part of a much bigger plan, and with this being Raish's ship and a predetermined destination. I was left thinking maybe we will go to Harry's homeworld and we'll see a clone of Harry being hidden by his people. Uh-oh. It's the Jim clone theory. Mm-hmm. Cloning has been shown to exist in the world. Wouldn't it make sense for Harry to have a clone as well, given what he knows?
Yes, it might make sense. I don't know. But it would remove the martyr a bit, right? Like, if he were actually still kind of alive.
But if he's a hidden, like, he doesn't have to announce himself. He just has to be. And also, if you're looking for one of those, what that disc behind his ear is, like, it could be like one of those altered carbon situations, like where there's a like stack? A transcortical stack that, you know, records in real time all your mental activity, so that if you plug that into a clone Harry's ear, then he's just going to flutter his eyes open and be all charming, articulate Jared Harris again.
Maybe he faked his death. Maybe he faked his death. Maybe this is something that's keeping his, life signs low, right? So he doesn't, his heart beats once per hour or something, and he's in sort of stasis rather than dead.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, again, Harry's is dead. Harry's is dead in the books, and that's it. So any of these, I'm a little resistant just because I still have like the core material that kind of pulls me back from those kind of drifts.
Sure.
But this show really is coloring outside the lines when it comes to book, again, for its benefit. So I don't know. It could be going something like that. Because again, you know, there was no such thing as cloning as far as I can recall in the original books either. So this is all a show invention. We'll see out where it goes. Two, the hologram simulation of Harry really puzzled me. It's kind of insinuated that Harry's death could have been a hoax, but then how would they put a real body in that space coffin? Or was it like the training simulations we've seen before, Harry and Raish practicing out Harry's death? But again, that felt like it was adding something to the story moving forward. Anyway, I really do feel like we'll discover something on Harry's home planet that will be the key to the rest of the season. Just wanted to see what your thoughts are on this. That's a real head scratcher to me, because it seems like the ship thinks Raish is on board.
Mm-hmm.
Why the fuck would you send the hologram of Harry dying to Raish? Like, to taunt him?
And how would it get that image? Because it was a very specific type of death, right? A gut wound from a knife. Is that how he always planned on doing it? He was just going to take himself out with a gut wound? That's rough.
And like the convulsing and like the digital. Honestly, that was very mysterious and weird to me. And I'm really looking forward to touching back in with Gale's story, because I fucking don't know, man.
Maybe the thing behind his ear is that he's recording his death on that thing somehow and uploading it to the escape pod, which then transfers it to the ship. I don't know.
Could be. We'll have like so many things in the show. We'll have to see.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
Slappy Dappy from Twitch, while listening to your absolutely excellent as always podcast, oh, you're going to make me blush, Slappy, on episode 4 of Foundation and ruminating on this awesome show, I started to think about the classic great man theory of history and its detractors. I assume you're familiar, but if not, here's a brief overview from Wikipedia of the central points relevant to my comment and question. The great man theory is a 19th century idea according to which history can largely be explained by the impact of great men or heroes, highly influential and unique individuals who, due to their natural abilities such as superior intellect, heroic courage, extraordinary leadership abilities, or divine inspiration, have a decisive historical effect. This theory is usually contrasted with history from below, which emphasizes the life of the masses in addition to their leaders. An overwhelming wave of smaller events causes certain developments to occur. Proponents of the great man theory argue that genetic anomalies in the brains of these great men are the decisive factor by introducing an original influence into their environment. There might therefore offer original ideas, discoveries, inventions, and perspectives which would not, in the mind of another individual, have engendered just that conclusion. It flashes out of one brain and no other because the instability of that brain is such as to tip and upset itself in just that particular direction. So I thought the support of this theory of genetic anomalies was particularly interesting to compare to Sho's use of Cleon, a clone with non-unique genetics and capable of introducing an original influence as the obvious great man. I have no familiarity with the source material, so I can't tell whether or say what's Asimov's view or thesis, but between the Cleons, Harry Seldon, and the mass population groups introduced such far, such as Illuminism, subsurface Trantorites, Anacreons, and Terminus's Seldonites, it certainly seems that the show writers are setting up this debate, and I wondered if you guys would weigh in on the Foundation stance on the great man theory. Is it yours? Well, let's talk about this. So what did Asimov think? I think that Asimov was probably since this was based on the rise, fall, and decline of the West Roman Empire, which was written in the 18th or 19th century at the height of the great man theory. I bet a lot of this is seen through that lens, and thus a lot of Asimov stuff is seen through that lens as well.
Yeah.
You know, like you like, and if my recollection of the books, you always had like some kind of, you know, kind of great leader that's at the right place at the right time that had a unique insight about the Seldon crises and the guidance they received from the plan and the courage to do this or that in the face of, and that's what saved the day more than a collective like pressure from below. But you're I think right, you're though, right.
The ironic use of the great man here is sort of interesting. When the great man is the stagnation, right? When the special emperor, the chosen one, whatever, is the guy who is keeping everything status quo.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting inversion of it.
And as far as, like, you know, is it great man theory or is it history from below? I'm going to defer to, like, Forrest Gump's wisdom and say it's probably both. You know, like, if you had Julius Caesar, the supreme tactical commander and gifted glad hander and, you know, gifted leader, charismatic. If you put him back in hunter-gatherer society with a small tribe of, you know, 30, 40 Neanderthals or whatever, he's just a guy getting twigs and berries out there, you know? His great man doesn't amount for shit.
Yeah.
You take, like, Martin Luther King Jr. and you put him in, like, 1855 America, I doubt he can stop the Civil War.
Yeah.
Like, we all, the masses of us, create conditions that then, you know, individual leaders are thrust forward into the stage or take the stage by force and then do things. But, like, I don't think they can do that without, like I said, I think it's both. Like, you got to recognize the leadership of great people over time, but also without the society that they come from, what does the great man or woman have to do? So,
and it's a bit of pointing to, like, one of the specific monkeys on the typewriter saying that one's special because it wrote a work of Shakespeare. Well, no, right. It just, the probabilities work out such that one of them had to. Doesn't make that one special. It just makes that one the one, right?
Yeah. And also, like, you know, going back to Martin Luther King Jr., Martin Luther King Jr. is like, you know what? This is all terrible, but I'm just going to keep looking after my flock and I'm just going to be preaching to my church and I'm going to let somebody else worry about. Someone else would have stepped forward. In fact, there was dozens of people working in the civil rights movement in the 60s. And, you know, maybe John Lewis is the Martin Luther King that we remember. Mm-hmm. So it's like it's one of those things where it's like, I think it's both. You do have individual, but those individuals are not as important because, just like we talked about earlier in the feedback, if somebody had failed to step forward in history, the conditions that caused them to step forward would have propelled someone else, maybe not as qualified, maybe more qualified. But, you know, there's just so much luck and positioning to all this. And that's how I feel like it works. I don't think it's one or the other. They wrap up, Slappy Dappy wraps up their thoughts with their statement on it. For me, Luminism, the Trantor Subterraneans, the Outer Rim, and Selden's group seem as great examples of masses making history from below. And psychohistory statistical predictive modeling seems consistent with the great man theory criticism, but Harry Seldon or Cleon the First would be classic great men, as they seem very important to opposing sides. But as you mentioned in the last podcast, individuals throwing a stone causes ripples. That's not necessarily a prediction of the person, but the effect of the action that the same person will likely take. Again, it's kind of hard to square with Harry, who seems to be setting up outcomes through personal action affecting masses. Can you clear this up for me? I feel like this is a lot of, like, when we went through the, like, four examples of potential plot holes of psychohistory, that it's like, I guess if you understood psychohistory and you saw all the variables, like that man that's staring at the chalkboard, it'd be really easy to go up and erase one variable and change it if you had the agency to do so. And Harry was put in a position where he had a few moments of those agencies where his coming forward with the, you know, like he was able to plan when he went public with his findings. Like he said, this is the optimum time. So he is the variable. History through accident or design has led him to be that, and he can smudge the numbers and put something else. Later, when he survives the trial, he can then stab himself in the guts and alter the equation again. But now apparently he's done. So who else is going to be the one that kind of guides the thing? Because,
yeah,
you know, the psychohistory predicts the empire will fall. It doesn't necessarily say when and, you know, for precision, how long. It's just like he's saying, like, the Dark Ages could last as long as 30,000 years. But if we take decisive action, we can shorten that. So it's like, again, it's like Forrest Gump says, you know, are we like Lieutenant Dan? We got our destiny predetermined, or we're like Mom's Feather. We're just kind of floating on the breeze. It's a little bit of both. We're mostly floating on the breeze, but every once in a while we have the winds calm and we can make a decision. And I'm almost certain the show is going to explore that, because that's stuff that the books cover as well. So We'll have to see. We're in the middle of the first season of an 8-season show, so we're very, very, very much in early beginnings. That's the mailbag for this week. I'm excited to see what people have to ask David Goyer. I'm excited to see what we end up asking David Goyer. Mm-hmm. We're going to be working on our outlines, too. I'm really excited to see the next episode and see what you guys think of that. Remember, foundation@baldmove.com is the only way to send us feedback for the podcast. Like before, we're going to, I guess this is the first time, we're going to release episode 6 at 3 a.m. approximately Eastern Standard Time on Friday morning. That's when the Apple embargo ends. And then we'll have a feedback episode out the following Tuesday. So that's the new pattern going forward. Fresh episode on Friday, fresh podcast covering that episode on Friday, feedback episode on Tuesday, and then we just repeat the cycle until the season's over. So I think it works a lot better because we had 50 minutes of feedback. We would have had like a 3-hour podcast that last episode, yeah. And that's a lot of talking. It's a lot of too talking much. In one go. So I'm glad we're doing it this way. Hope you guys like it as well. We'll see you Friday for the new episode. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.